Washington Week, news and analysis. I'm Neil Strausser, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Stonewalling was the phrase often heard in those transcripts of presidential conversations. And this week, that is what it was. The president, through his lawyer, James St. Clair, taking his stand.
He is not above the law. It's his duty to carry out the law. And the law is that he is the president, that he should not do anything to subvert that office to any other branch of the government.
That meant no to the courts, to the special prosecutor, and to the House Judiciary Committee on furnishing of any more White House tapes or files. The no to the House Committee found even a staunch Republican member, Lawrence Hogan of Maryland, saying that the American people may now conclude that the president has something to hide.
Well, it is very definitely disappointing that the White House has, to use their word, decided to stonewall the committee's request. We have a responsibility to get to the bottom of the charges made against the president, and unless we're given access to the information which will either prove his culpability or his innocence, I think that we're in a bad situation.
And despite the warnings of Judge Gerhard Gesell that the case might have to be dismissed, the president said no also to releasing the files of Charles Colson and John Ehrlichman, two of the defendants in the Ellsberg break-in case. That issue appeared headed for the Supreme Court, along with Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski's bid to obtain tapes for the Watergate cover-up trial. Jaworski's surprise move direct to the High Court followed a flurry earlier this week when Jaworski complained to the Senate Judiciary Committee that the White House was trying to undercut his authority by contending he had no independent standing in court in his suit for the tapes. There was speculation that Jaworski would be fired, but the White House said no to that also. The no to the House Judiciary Committee came as the committee continued its closed-door hearings, the week's activity reported by Bruce Morton.
They put on their gray stereophonic earphones, listened, and then disagreed about what they heard. For example, in that famous March 21st meeting, the edited White House transcripts show the president saying to John Dean, apparently in reference to hush money, expletive deleted, get it. Three different committee members thought they heard three different deleted expletives and told reporters so. Elizabeth Holtzman of New York said she knew which one it really was, but she wouldn't tell. More importantly, Waldie of California interpreted what he heard as a direct presidential command to pay hush money. Latta of Ohio must have heard something else. He said the tape helped the president's case. Wiley Main of Iowa summed it up. Listening to the tapes, it's every man for himself. We all hear something different. But maybe for that very reason, the committee members ended the week more convinced than ever that they want tapes, not edited transcripts. Wanting isn't getting, though, and the president made it clear this week he will yield nothing, will disobey the subpoenas the committee already has issued and any others it might issue later on. The committee launched a public relations counterattack, staff chiefs John Doerr and Albert Jenner attacking the accuracy of the partial White House transcripts. What else to do? Some Republicans wanted to go to court. Chairman Peter Rodino opposes that and has the votes to make his opposition stick. Democrat John Conyers wants to ask the full House to cite the president for contempt of Congress. Rodino opposes that. He will continue to subpoena needed evidence, building a record. Eventually, that pile of unanswered subpoenas may turn into an impeachable offense. And when voting on the other charges, committee members may agree with Republican Hogan of Maryland that the human thing to do is to assume the president has something to hide. Neil?
From his vantage point with the presidential party in Florida, another view of the White House stand from CBS News White House correspondent Robert Pierpoint.
In recent months, President Nixon has appeared to establish a pattern in handling demands for information about his involvement in Watergate. First, he asks for a delay, more time to consider the request or subpoena or whatever. Then lets it be known, usually by carefully calculated leaks to the press, that he does not intend fully to honor the request. And finally, at the very last moment, he gives in a little. But this week, that pattern shifted, and true to leaks and predictions of the past 2 weeks, President Nixon formally refused to turn over any more information to anyone. This was the case almost across the board. Refusal to give any more information to the Watergate Committee of the Senate, to the special prosecutor, to a federal court in a criminal indictment of Ehrlichman and Colson for the burglary of Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. And perhaps most important of all, to the House Judiciary Committee in its impeachment inquiry. In refusing that committee, President Nixon wrote Chairman Rodino that he would not comply with either outstanding or future subpoenas for more information. And he declared, continuing ad infinitum, the process of yielding up additional conversations in response to an endless series of demands would fatally weaken this office. That, of course, is the now familiar argument of executive privilege. In most cases, it may work, but in this one, it could contain a fatal flaw. The president may have guaranteed at least one count against himself in the impeachment proceedings, since many committee members believe that refusal to comply with their subpoena is itself an impeachable offense. Other members of the committee may not completely agree, but the president's action this week in defying that body certainly did not gain him votes. Robert Pierpoint, CBS News, with the presidential party in Florida.
As the president's 1 year of Watergate stretched on, the Watergate Special Prosecution Task Force this week marked its 1 year anniversary. The task force, which began under Archibald Cox and has continued under Jaworski, announced that its investigation of the Watergate break-in and cover-up is nearly completed and the Dirty Tricks probe is in its final stages. The statement noted that 22 persons have now been convicted or pleaded guilty to some crime. The latest to prepare to go off to jail was former White House and campaign aide Jeb Stuart Magruder. Magruder this week receiving a minimum 10-month sentence.
I can't say I'm looking forward to going to prison, but I expected to, and I will do it, and I hope to serve my time and come out, and hopefully the public will accept the fact that I've paid a penalty for the crimes that I did commit in the Watergate case.
As the Watergate story continued to swirl around him, President Nixon this week pressed on with a business-as-usual stance. The White House at week's end said that Mr. Nixon will visit the Middle East in the near future, and earlier it reaffirmed the president's intention to go to Moscow for his summit conference late next month. That came after Republican Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts said the president should not go unless there is an arms limitation agreement worked out in advance and approved by congressional leaders. Brooke citing Watergate pressures, which he said could weaken the president.
I think that the president would be susceptible to pressures from the Soviet Union. I think that his desire, sort of a compulsive desire to succeed, would be injurious to him and place him in an untenable position.
Twice this week, the president spoke on radio, on Monday offering some degree of compromise with the Congress on competing health insurance plans, an offer welcomed by Senator Edward Kennedy, co-author of the major congressional version.
Every day that passes, there are young people and old people alike that are denied the kind of quality health care which they desperately need. The problem is only increasing in dimension, and I feel that this is the time and this is the year to provide comprehensive health insurance.
On Saturday, Mr. Nixon spoke on the economy, announcing the appointment of Deputy Secretary of State Kenneth Rush to serve as his economic policy counselor or coordinator in the White House. The president conceding a production slowdown and soaring inflation, but still saying the quality of American life has held up.
In view of the international stresses on our economy and the gloomy predictions that were widespread at the beginning of the year, this has been a good performance. More importantly, there are also encouraging signs today that the worst is behind us. The storms are abating. As the effects of the recent oil shortage have passed, the production levels of automobiles have begun to rise again, and industrial production overall is showing an increase for the first time in almost half a year. Our efforts to dampen inflation are also beginning to pay off.
Mr. Nixon cited falling food prices and signs of a leveling off in gasoline prices. His prescription for economic recovery remained the same: budgetary restraint, no tax cut, and tight money. The president conceding it sounded like harsh medicine, but saying it was the only possible way. At the end of a Washington week produced by Ellen Wadley, I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News.